Hello everybody, my name is Anna Bruce. I'm a curator of the exhibition Spectral White, The Appearance of Colonial Europeans, together with Anselm Franke. And I have the honor to introduce our first speaker tonight, Siraj Rasool. Well, before I do that, I have to say that we have a very dense program tonight. We have also, after these two papers, events that are part of the Afrosonic Mapping exhibition. So we have to stay in time, and there will be no Q&A, but the speakers would be happy to speak to you in the bar afterwards if you have questions. Siraj Rasool is professor of history and director of the African program in Museum and Heritage Studies at the University of Western Cape in Cape Town, where he's centrally involved in the reformulation of museum work in the context of the post-apartheid society in South Africa. Siraj also directs the Remaking Societies, Remaking Persons Supranational Forum, a collaborative forum between various universities in South Africa, Uganda, the American University of Cairo and Beirut, and they set new standards in rethinking museums, heritage, and memory work. He also published widely about museum cultural heritage and the politics of memory and human remains. He co-authored and edited The Politics of Heritage in Africa, Economies, Histories, and Infrastructures in 2015, Unsettled History, Making South African Public Past 2017, and Missing and Missed, Subject Politics, Memorialization in 2018. He has been on the boards of the district's six museums and Iziko museums of South Africa and previously chaired the scientific committee of the International Council of African Museums. Tonight, Siraj is going to speak about rethinking the ethnographic in museums in South Africa and Germany, mimicry, violence, and the challenges of decolonization.
Thank you very much, Anna, for those kind words and for the invitation to talk at the HKV tonight. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming. I want to start by going back to some of my old work that is always unfinished and is always sitting somewhere on a desk waiting for its opportunity to occupy my mind, and maybe this is that time, as I think we're at a very peculiar moment, both in South Africa and in Germany, when museums as we understand them or as we have understood them are going through such rapid fundamental moments of being rethought that at the end of this process we will not recognize the museum that we have known before. And I want to talk through some of the ways in which we've been rethinking museum and some of the challenges and the legacies that we live with and continue to live with. And I want to tell you, I mean, one of the central points that I want to make is that in South Africa and in Germany, we have lost a history of disciplines, and we have lost a sense of the collecting history that understands the ethnographic in a history of violence. And what I want to put to you today, certainly from the perspective of South Africa, is that the kind of framework of liberal paternalism, atonement, through which we've understood the ethnographic needs to come to terms with the history of violence that accompanied that history. In other words, there's been an artificial separation between what in Germany is called ethnologie and anthropologie, and in South Africa we've had that troubling history as well. And so we're also at a moment where we are being called upon to think about violence in colonial history. And the series of conferences that we've been having across Germany, Stuttgart, Leipzig, and last month in maybe 2 months ago in Cologne. It just brought home just how our central violence needs to be in the epistemic work that we need to do in rethinking museum. So this talk will examine how Khoisan and other African people became subjects of projects of preservation through folklore documentation, the convergence of science and spectacle, and the entry of the dead body into the museum. In South Africa, projects crafted in the name of recovery and preservation through the performance of indigeneity have often occurred through a politics of atonement and liberal paternalism that serves to reproduce rather than question colonial violence. Nevertheless, as we shall see, some of the most powerful interactions have also seen instances of counter-reproduction through mimicry and a critique of the rituals of science and anthropology. Now, over a 14-year period between 1870 and 1884, a set of research encounters took place in Mowbray, in Cape Town, between German philologist Wilhelm Bleck, his sister-in-law Lucy Lloyd, and a group of Khoisan Xam speakers from the Karoo region. Convicted on charges of stock theft and other crimes arising out of defensive acts against colonial encroachment, the Xam speakers had been incarcerated at the Breakwater Prison. And for those of you who visit Cape Town and go to Cape Town's waterfront, you will know the Breakwater Prison, which is now the site of a graduate school of business of a local university. Where at this Breakwater Prison, where they had also been subjects of racial research and anthropometric photography. Those late 19th century encounters and engagements, mediated by the efforts of Lloyd and later Black's daughter Dorothea, gave rise to a material assemblage, a collection of testimonies, transcripts, translations, traces, and artifacts. These took the form of letters, glass photographic plates, numerous notebooks, and more than 450 printed pages of specimens of Bushman folklore. These materials came to be held across three collecting institutions: the National Library of South Africa, then the South African Public Library, where Black and later Lloyd worked as librarians on the Sir George Grey collection. And for those scholars here of Oceania, you will know that the Cape shares Sir George Grey with New Zealand, where George Grey was governor on two occasions in New Zealand and governor at the Cape, and whose collections were the founding collections of the National Library of South Africa, as well as the Auckland Library, and where there are also Grey materials in the Auckland Museum. The testimony and folklore recorded by Blake and Lloyd achieved importance a century later in the 1970s and the 1980s, when selections thereof were marshaled in the archaeological interpretation of rock art in Southern Africa. Out of these interpretations, a dominant view of the significance of these records has sought to understand rock art in Southern Africa by recourse to theories of shamanism. Much of this work has centered on David Lewis Williams and his interpretations, and there are a host of associated representations in the academy and the field of heritage that draw upon this work. This dominant perspective is to be found in books published since the 1980s, in the work of a major rock art research center, as well as in a range of museums and exhibitions. Generally, following this dominant perspective, initiated by David Lewis Williams, Jeanette Deacon has been one of the main scholars who studied the Black Lloyd records to understand rock art as the physical signs of a San spirit world and religious beliefs. Perhaps Deacon's most significant contribution has been her efforts to identify and map the actual locations from which the Klam speakers came and to which they refer in their stories. Her work, which was inspired by that of Lewis Williams, saw her undertake various field trips to the Northern Cape. What followed was an archaeological study of the rock engravings in the area of the grass and the flat bushmen, as they have been named, which tried to draw connections with Klam beliefs and customs as contained in the 19th century records. For Deacon, the Black Lloyd collection were records of the Klam cognitive system, which also recorded valuable information for understanding such elements as the metaphors expressed in the rock art of Southern Africa and the close bond that existed between these indigenous people and the landscape in which they lived. Now, Lewis Williams suggested that Willem Black had been a man before his time, for whom Bushman and European languages were equals. In a similar vein, Jeanette Deacon argued in 1996 that what had unfolded in Mowbray had been a remarkable relationship between two families who were drawn together in a joint effort to record the language and folklore of the Klam, the descendants of the indigenous son of the Northern Cape. The Black Lloyd records, she suggested, had been the result of remarkable mutual respect and cooperation between interviewers and interviewees. The Black family of scholars were committed to a cause that must have seemed esoteric in the extreme to many of their contemporaries. Without the personal sacrifice on the part of the two families, it was said, we would know virtually nothing of the Klam and their cognitive system. The archive has been described as the closest thing we have to a Bushman voice from the 19th century. Now, alongside Lewis Williams, Jeanette Deacon's scholarship has been central to ensuring that shamanist and neuropsychological interpretations of rock art have been combined with understandings of rock art's main interpretive archive, the Black Lloyd records, that have stressed remarkable equality and cultural salvage. This paradigm has come to dominate the field of rock art conservation in South Africa and beyond through the influence of the work of the Rock Art Research Institute in Johannesburg, now connected to a relatively new museum at the University of the Witwatersrand, called Origin Center. Here I want to suggest that these notions of cultural salvage and remarkable equality have served to create a kind of cult out of Willem Black and Lucy Lloyd, whose archive has been understood in a very limited way as a system of linguistic and cultural documentation and which has been mined for a lost, extinct authenticity. These dominant meanings and idealized notions of significance were incorporated into World Heritage when the Black Lloyd Collection at the University of Cape Town and the South African Library, the National Library of South Africa, was inscribed on the register of UNESCO's Memory of the World Program in 1997. According to the nomination form, Black and Lloyd's notebook served as a Rosetta Stone, which has enabled scholars to decipher the meaning of Southern African rock art. As the main researcher and thinker behind the Iziko South African Museum's rock art exhibition, The Power of Rock Art, that opened in December 2003. Jeanette Deacon took her perspectives into the field of museum display for the purposes of public access. The production of this exhibition saw the dominant shamanist paradigm, the neuropsychological paradigm, and the Black Lloyd cult of salvation and remarkable equality being combined with a politics of consultation that sought authority in authenticity. And the main voices of authentic indigeneity were Mu-speaking elders from Upington and Witdraai, with whom the linguist Nigel Crawhall had been working on behalf of the South African Sound Institute on projects documenting Mu language, mapping personal and community histories, place names, and compiling a biodiversity resource history. While Nigel Crawhall's language research showed enormous potential for transcending ethnic and race paradigms, his participation on the exhibition's academic committee saw him become the deliverer of Indigenous participation and authentication. The assembled Indigenous, in turn, would be able to reflect with a sense of gratitude upon the implied chain of salvation and benefaction, beginning with Black and Lloyd's documentation and culminating in the museum exhibition itself. The problem with all this work is that in spite of its mushrooming in the post-apartheid era and its deep concern with Indigenous heritage, it is remarkable that almost nowhere do you find an engagement with the blood and brutality of the Khoisan experience. In addition, despite a growing corpus of scholarship on collections, mediation, and the production of knowledge, including serious post-colonial scholarship on archives in South Africa, the approach to the Black Lloyd records in Deacon's work and in the Black Lloyd canon in South Africa more generally remained couched in the language of recovery and authenticity. And nowhere in the Black Lloyd canon is the archive engaged with from the point of view of its mediations, except for the idea of salvage. Instead, this recuperative preservationist perspective has been reproduced over and over through coffee table books, exhibitions, films that have sought to recover an authentic hunter-gatherer bushman. This exhibition and scholarship was located within a paradigm of liberal paternalism, authenticity, and cultural atonement that ultimately reproduced the syndrome of discovery. Now, this Power of Rock Art exhibition in some ways replaced an infamous Khoisan display that was closed on April the 3rd, 2001, in what was seen by many as a landmark moment in the history of cultural display. Perhaps one of the most famous exhibitions at any museum in the world that became the source of tremendous controversy over the museum in South Africa, and which opened in 1959 and 1960, created by Margaret Shaw, then the museum ethnographer. And what's interesting about that exhibition is that it saw the transition from physical anthropology to cultural anthropology, where the figures that are in the diorama are body casts made at the beginning of the 20th century by Louis Peringuey and James Drury, the museum modeler, from information given to them by none other than Dorothea Blake, on where to go in the Northern Cape, which mission stations, which villages, and through a network of missionaries and police stations, the South African Museum went into the Northern Cape to make live body casts from the bodies of farm workers and shepherds, and for these to stand as physical records of race that entered the South African Museum collection as racial studies, but which later, 1959, 1960, when you saw a transition from physical anthropology to cultural history, this is what the result was. And this display, this diorama, stood at the beginning of what was called the African Cultures Gallery, in which the state ethnologist Van Warmelo, who did the work on deciding who in South Africa was a tribe and who was not a tribe, the Van Warmelo system of ethnic arrangement was put on show in what became known as the African Cultures Gallery, with dioramas of tribes put on display and their material cultures, either with models or with casts at the center thereof. And this African Cultures Gallery was only closed about a year or two ago, partly as a result of protest action by younger activists, which who described that hall of the now in Iziko South African Museum as a colonial crime scene. So what is interesting about, so this display was closed in 2001, shut down amid strong feelings expressed by some staff members that the act of closure smacked of political correctness and that it appeared to be a knee-jerk reaction. The diorama was boarded up and archived, symbolizing the museum's commitment to change. Subsequently, the diorama was dismantled and the body casts were declared by its count, by Iziko Museum's council, to be unethically collected human remains. Because, in fact, the debate in South Africa and the heated discussions that had taken place around body casts, in fact, served as maybe an alibi, diverting attention from what had become a more nefarious legacy, that a collecting history that occurred at the same time by the very same Louis Peringuey and James Drury at the same time went about the Northern Cape as they were making body casts. They were also acquiring human remains disinterred illegally from graves and doing so in competition with European scientists who were on the scene also purchasing either bodies or skeletons, which were exported to Europe. And at the same time as these specimens of race and physical anthropology were being collected, on the same ox wagons and on the same transportation system to the museums in the Cape and to the museums in Europe were forms of cultural documentation and what became known as ethnographic materials, all collected together and brought to Cape Town, and in the case of the Austrian anthropologist Rudolf Perch, taken to Vienna, where they have become subject to an incomplete negotiation between the South African government and the Austrian government. So, in fact, one of the arguments that my colleague Martin Legasic and I have made is that more than these body casts, Human remains lie at the center of the emergence of the modern museum in South Africa as institutions of order, classification, and knowledge at the turn of the 20th century. Human remains provided the basis for the founding of the McGregor Museum in Kimberley and was central to the development of the South African Museum in the age of anthropology. And most people might presume that these human remains were excavated by professional archaeologists and that they are the fossilized remains of long dead people, collected perhaps as part of research on prehistory, evolution, human origins. What has been largely left unexamined in the history of anthropology, archaeology, and museums is the way that many of these remains were acquired, particularly around the turn of the century, in which you actually have, we have evidence of an incipient trade in human remains between grave robbers, South African museums, and museums in Europe, where there was an intense rivalry and competition among museums about any future possession of the skeletons, even of still living persons, as well as the digging up of very recently buried bodies. And our study examines the ethics of these exhumations, and in the light of this, the appropriate steps for placing the issue of human remains in museums on the agenda of both the academy and the museum. At the heart of the institutional history of the museum in South Africa in the 20th century was a competitive and insatiable trade in human remains to a significant extent of the newly dead and in some cases of the still living, involving close connections by men and women of science in South African museums and beyond with gross acts of plunder and the defilement of human bodies, where the Southern Kalahari and the Northern Cape more generally were part of an enormous field site stretching from southern Namibia across to then Botswana land for the acquisition of human remains that were central to racial research in South Africa and Europe. And the failure of the academy and museums to examine these political questions squarely derived from a perpetuation of the idea that the bones and skulls of Khoisan people in the 20th century were natural history fossils, referred to as relics at the beginning of the 20th century. And in fact, South Africa's first law on heritage, the Bushman Relics Act, came into existence not so much to regulate the traffic in rock engravings, but to regulate the traffic in human remains. So in addressing these legacies, we have come, in the last year or two, we have come a long way. There is general understanding that that there is no place for human remains in museums of culture, and that dead bodies and skeletons collected in these ways do not belong in museums. And there is policy emerging in South Africa, and that has developed in Germany, and there is a lot of work happening in the Lushan project here in Berlin that has resulted in returns of human remains to Namibia with returns imminent to Rwanda and possibly also to South Africa as the provenance research happens. There's certainty that that has happened. In South Africa, human remains policies have emerged where at Iziko, all of the remains that are deemed to have been unethically collected, namely those stolen from their graves or those collected for the purposes of racial science, have been demarcated, taken out of the collection, deaccessioned, and awaiting a national policy of repatriation and restitution for those remains to be buried close to the places from which they come. And you can imagine the task that is going to be at hand, in which the new period, the new phase of the museum that we are transforming is going to involve restitution and repatriation, where these are not events that are going to happen, but these are going to be the new program. These are going to be the new museum. But inside of that, what's also important in South Africa at Iziko Museums, one has to give them their due when that due is due, that some of its most important work has been epistemic, in which the classificatory division that you in Germany would be familiar with, that we have all over the world, that mutatis mutandis has occurred as a feature of the modern museum, that division between cultural history and ethnologie, that fundamental museum division in collections and institutions of display in South Africa was obviously found to be completely untenable in the process of remaking a democracy, in which the project of democratizing the society has also had to have an impact on the museum. And so at Iziko Museums, they've created a new collections division in which these previously segregated collections are being united in the process of collections management. Extremely important work, and I think one of the still too rare examples of how this is taking place, and something that the South Africans should be exporting to other parts of the world as part of the project of decolonization. Because what decolonization means to young people, to people in Germany, to people in South Africa, to people in different parts of the world, obviously differs. We do not have a single holus bolus kind of approach. And I will come to some of those questions as they relate to Germany later on. But for now, I want to go to another part of this genealogy. And that, of course, is the cover of my unfinished book. You get to see it beautifully. It's a scene from the Rosebank Showgrounds in Cape Town of a group of people from the Kalahari that were brought to Cape Town, put on display at the Rosebank Showgrounds. But before that, were put on display at in 1936 at the Empire Exhibition in Johannesburg in a display that was held to celebrate the 50th birthday of Johannesburg, and where, quite frankly, which are an Empire Exhibition, which really is the origins of what is called Origin Center at the University of the Witwatersrand, where their collections come from, but which they deny, and which they do not figure because it wouldn't look cool and fundable to focus on that history. And so I suppose the argument that I'm making here is that you cannot get to indigeneity without facing up to the violence. And so I'm going to show you some extremely traumatic photographs. I'm going to show them to you very quickly because these are not photographs that need to be shown. And I'm going to show you where this project began on this part in the Kalahari, and people who spoke the language Mu, the very people whose remains were collected at the beginning of the 20th century, put at the foundation of the museum and taken to Austria, and people who were put to flight in the first few years of the 20th century from southern Namibia as the genocide was underway. People took refuge. This is a community who always lived on different sides of the border, or a transnational community, but were turned into laborers, into Afrikaans-speaking laborers and Khoikhoi Gowab-speaking farm workers in the Northern Cape. And one of the arguments that I've made is one of the reasons why they concealed their language knowledge of Ngu was not just that they were told that this is a shameful language and that Christianization meant that you need to speak Afrikaans, but that people concealed this language as a means of protecting their dead. Because if they did not speak Ngu, then they would simply be mixed colored people. They would not be regarded as authentic and as Bushmen. And so what we have now, I'm going to show you a typical steatopegic photograph of the same woman. This is a woman by the name of Panaku, who was the daughter of Urike, also known as O Abram, who was the leader of the group for whom Donald Bain, who you see with the walking stick, was mounting a campaign with the South African government for the creation of a Bushman reserve for the preservation of the Bushman. And what he did was he called in a team of scientists from the University of the Witwatersrand that undertook a field expedition and created what was called a laboratory in the desert with field equipment for measurement, for the careful physical study of people's bodies in order to determine, to select a group of 70 people to be taken to Johannesburg to be put on display. And one of the images, one of the ways that people were researched is through the typical physical anthropological photography, that anthropometric photography that you would know about. And I'm going to show you and one of those images. It's a trauma image because it has further trauma placed on it as this image was found in the collection of the Native Commissioner of Ovamboland in Namibia. So this is, and it consists of additions to the photograph. I'm going to show it to you very quickly with a swastika placed on her body in a kind of a hyper-focalization, but a kind of pornography of violence committed and perpetrated onto the body that was part of the circulation, the recirculation, the resignification of these images. And I'm just going to show you in Cape Town. This is actually a photograph taken by my grandmother's sister who went to the Empire exhibition in Johannesburg and photographed Panaku. The group was taken on a walk through Cape Town, also called a walk, a march to Parliament, and were put in a photographic studio, in a recording studio where they did one of the first international live broadcasts. That's the original photograph. And then there are also casts of parts of Panaku's body in the University of Cape Town. And the reason why it is necessary for us to understand these histories and how they are connected to each other over time is that we are dealing with a history of anthropology, of cultural anthropology that has been separated from these histories, and in both in South Africa and in Germany, and where it is necessary to understand how the records of cultural documentation, of sound recordings, field sound recordings, photography, the collection of cultural artifacts are fundamentally connected to violent forms of representation. This is also becoming apparent as we think through German histories, as we think through the future of the museum in Germany, where the first phase of provenance research that has happened in German museums has revealed the extent to which many cultural artifacts turn out to have been mislabeled in the collection. Where in the very project that has been unfolding in this city, involving a partnership between the Ethnologisches Museum Dahlem en route to Humboldt Forum with the Museums Association of Namibia, involving colleagues from the Museums Association spending time in the collections, project initiated by, among others, Larissa Furster and Jonathan Fine, have brought to the fore extremely interesting moments in which it becomes very clear that certain objects were collected at the time of the genocide and in the moment of violence and where our colleagues are beginning to think about when did soldiers collect the object and when did they do killing? Did they collect first and kill second, or kill first and collect second? What is the order? And it's very clear from the provenance research in Stuttgart and elsewhere what the dates of entry of objects are and where they came. And in other words, the category of the ethnographic with pertaining to African collections from Namibia and from elsewhere has lost a history of violence, and that needs to be brought to the fore far more importantly. And so some of the challenges I think that German museums face, as it's been very interesting as a South African, as an African, to think about these questions while spending time in Germany, inside of the debates, but not just as an African, but someone who has been trained in a field that hardly exists in Germany, in the field of African history, in which our debates about anthropology have occurred in relation to the development of African history as a field, in which, in some senses, these are disciplines, certainly in South Africa and in other parts of the world, that are in conversation and in debate with each other, where as an African historian, you're always a bit of an anthropologist, and where the discipline of African history is one that came with African struggles for freedom, with liberation movements. And it's very interesting to think about Germany and its museums and its collections in a society that did not face national liberation movements, that were not pressured from below to go through changes. And so you almost find almost untransformed disciplines like Africanistik is not African studies as we understand it in other parts of the world, where you have the coming together of ethnologie and Sprachkunde in a disciplinary formation pertaining to a people and a continent. And so it's very important that we understand those specificities and to be able to embark upon remaking museums, to embark upon decolonization, not as an overnight event, not as something that will happen when things are returned, because we are in this phase of return. In fact, return sets up a new agenda for how we remake ourselves ethically. You will know that the report by Benedict Savoy and Felwyn Sars talk about a new ethics and a new kind of person. And we are indeed in this new era of restitution as the basis of the new museum, in which this great institution, whose formation was supposed to have been inaugurated this week in Berlin, but which has been postponed until next year, we're told because of air conditioning. But we know there are deeper reasons, there are epistemic reasons when this is going to be a museum born out of its time, a museum that is going to be created at a time of restitution and repatriation, in which this oddity of the reinvention of a Schloss and the 19th century past as the basis of a magnificent new museum is just going to be so anachronistic and out of time that we await that moment with enormous anticipation. Thank you very much. I know in Germany you prefer Q&A. In South Africa we collect, but it's okay. That's a very important question. And there are a variety of aspects to it. The debate that is happening in West Africa and in the Francophone African world is mainly about objects as artworks. And you know, there's one component of our debate has been in the relationship between ethnologie and Kunst, and the place of African art in the canon of world art. And so when Macron talks about restitution, this is configured as a restitution of artworks. Now, that might be the case. The debate in Southern Africa and East Africa is more of a claim about artifacts, with artworks being one of them. But there are also other kinds of materials. There's film, there's sound recordings, there are photographs, there are all number of interconnected objects and documentation that needs to be made available for negotiation. The field that I know best from my research are the collections that were assembled by Rudolf Perch and his assistants, and that found their way to the different collecting institutions in Vienna, to the Natural History Museum, the now renamed Weltmuseum, they're all world museums, to the Sound Archives, and where you can, because the South African archive is so clear, because these collections were happening at the time that South Africa was becoming a nation, and so it was laying a prior claim to these objects being in its own institutions. There were these inquiries from which we can name people. But I have begun to argue that the stolen rock engravings that were on the ox wagon with Klaas and Troy Pienaar, with Masebi, with Kreisband, and with the others who we can name on that ox wagon, whose bodies were either placed into barrels of salt or were boiled down to bone and wrapped in cloth for export. On the same ox wagon were these rock engravings, and there were cultural artifacts. We have been able to locate two of them in the collections in Vienna after years, in fact decades, of denial that they were ever exported from the Cape. But I'd like to think of these rock engravings as ancestral, as human remains, because they belong to the body. And this is not just an argument about the belongingness to the body that comes from grave goods that unearthed by archaeologists, as we always find. Our most important cultural artifacts in any museum in South Africa, the Mapungubwe golden objects, are grave goods. So apart from that, we learn from other African examples of how objects have life, how objects have a soul, about how objects weep, about the sadness of objects, about how then what work needs to happen of reconnection. And I mean, just from the work that we have been doing on the board, on the International Advisory Board of the Lushan Sammlung here in the Preußische Kulturbesitz, it's very clear that when you see the names of the anthropologists who collected human remains, they are the very same names that come up when you look at the collections of sound recordings. We think about the sound recordings in very different ways. We've come to understand them to be fundamentally about preservation of earlier times. We think of them in much more pleasant ways about forms of documentation. But when you see that relationship, then they belong to a history of violence that I think, lies underneath the museum. This is becoming a much more prevalent project. There are projects underway at the moment at Pitt Rivers, at the Horniman Museum, that are rethinking the object in relation to histories of violence. This is happening in fits and starts in Germany as well, but it has to be upscaled. And part of the problem, unfortunately, is that there's a kind of disconnect between, you know, in the alliances that have been formed between the post-colonial activists, the museum scholars, who sometimes come together over Namibia human remains. But actually, quite frankly, you need a much greater sense of coherence that understands the museum not just as a cupboard that needs to be emptied or that needs to be shifted somewhere else, but that understands the epistemologies that underpin them, and where decolonization takes hard epistemic work. Noch eins, bitte. Otherwise, thank you very much for listening. Thank you.